if you work in a hospital right now and you go to an ICU, you see patients with COVID who are very ill, patients who will go on to die of disease, and virtually all of them are unvaccinated.
These vaccines have been proven to be safe and effective. These vaccines reduce hospital admissions, they reduce the severity of individuals' illness, and protect from death, which is the goal.
Welcome to another episode of 5x5. This is APA Communications Director Greg Overman. This time around, we have Dr. Eric Rubin, who is Editor-in-Chief of the New England Journal of Medicine, consulting epidemiologist Dr. Richard Roth, APA President Captain Eric Ferguson, and our Medical Committee Chair Captain Pete Gillespie. These gentlemen are going to discuss what to expect in the coming months with regard to COVID-19. They'll also address some common misconceptions about the vaccines, along with natural immunity and antibody testing and vaccine side effects, all highly relevant and timely topics. So with that, let's get started. Gentlemen.
So where is the pandemic headed in the months ahead? And what would you say to folks that would say at this point, with widespread deployment of the vaccine, that it appears not to be doing any good at all? If you could kind of give us that along, perhaps inside of those answers related to where parts of the world are going, in contrast with the U.S., please. So Dr. Rubin or Dr. Roth, your choice.
First, the vaccine totally works. It works to prevent morbidity and mortality, people from getting very sick and people from dying. And that is very clear. If you work in a hospital right now and you go to an ICU, you see patients with COVID who are very ill, patients who will go on to die of disease, and virtually all of them are unvaccinated. Either that or they have pre-existing immune problems which don't allow them to respond well to vaccination. So the vaccine completely works to prevent serious disease. Where it's not as effective is preventing these breakthrough infections. That's because of the appearance of variants like the Delta variant that circulates right now. And the vaccine doesn't completely protect people against both infection and against mild disease. So we can still have mild disease in a highly vaccinated population, and we still can get transmission in that population. I think that there are efforts to make the vaccines better to prevent transmission, but they're not the perfect tools for preventing transmission. And that means it's a little hard to say where things are going right now. It's likely that in highly vaccinated places, there might continue to be disease, but there will be fewer hospitalizations and fewer deaths. Whereas in places with low vaccination rates, there'll be transmission plus deaths. We're much better off without those deaths and with being able to keep our hospitals open so that people who need them can get access to them. So vaccination is still a critical tool in controlling the impact of the epidemic, even if it's imperfect for preventing transmission.
To add to Dr. Rubin's eloquent description about the benefit of the vaccine, it's just, again, these vaccines have been proven to be safe and effective. These vaccines reduce hospital admissions. They reduce the severity of individuals' illness and protect from death, which is the goal. The ability of them to reduce transmission is a secondary gain, and that may be there, but we're not seeing it uniform as a benefit of the vaccine. The primary goal of the vaccine was to reduce people from needing hospitals or when in the hospital did not progress on to death. The next thing has to do with a crystal ball. Where are we going? What are we seeing elsewhere? And what we've seen in Western Europe and what we've seen on each of the different surges is we typically have followed the pattern that they have. And this is a very smart virus. It has very significant ability to create different variants. And these variants sometimes do, as variants are known to do, is get past the original umbrella of the vaccines that were first developed. We've now approved the ability to mix and match, where we're giving different brands, and that might expand the umbrella of protection. We are likely going to be looking at tailored vaccines as we look forward to next year or the year after, similar to that we do with influenza. where we come up with the different strains, or what some people use the word mutations. Lately, the terminology, the nomenclature is the variants. And we may have a tri or a quad valency vaccine, similar to the way that we cover for the different strains in influenza. Some of these vaccines in the future may also have other pathogens being protected in the same vaccine, i.e. what we do right now with tetanus is we give tetanus, diphtheria, and pertussis protection in one shot. We may have influenza included in some of these tailored vaccines of the next Greek letters. And we just don't know what the next Greek letters are. First, it was, beta, alpha, then delta plus, gamma, whatever fraternity house letters are in the future, phi, delta, gamma, Zulu, epsilon, they will be there in the future. And I think our vaccines, the technology is there where we can also tactically and strategically modify them as needed to gain protection. But there are holes in the current umbrella, and that's what we're seeing in these European countries, and those holes will also come to us.
Thank you, Dr. Roth. And speaking of the variants and all that might lay ahead related to, again, capturing those variants, quadrivalent, I think was the term you used. Let's talk about the full approval of the Pfizer / whatever they call it, Comirnaty vaccine. Perhaps Dr. Rubin can help us out since you're on the FDA panel. Can you discuss kind of the difference here between these two name brands and how do we know that they're safe?
So I'm going to summarize everything in one sentence. They're the same. There is no difference between something called by its trade name, Comirnaty in this case, or its generic name, which has the beautiful name BNT162B2. And the reason that drug companies give drugs names that are easier for people to pronounce and remember is for marketing reasons, but it has nothing to do with what's in the tube. Now, what's a little confusing, I think, for people, and I know there's been a lot of focus on this out on the internet, is that the legal documents and the legal status of these is perhaps a little more complicated than it needs to be. The drug or the vaccine is the vaccine. It is all the same, but sometimes it is licensed and sometimes it's authorized. But all that means is it depends on whose arm you put it in. If you give it to an adult and as part of the initial series, then it is licensed, meaning that the FDA has given full approval to that vaccine. If you give it to someone as a third dose, if you give it to a child right now, then it is authorized, meaning it has emergency use authorization. And in fact, actually children get a different vial because it's a smaller dose. But there are uses that are authorized and there are uses that are licensed. There is absolutely no difference between the products. The vaccine doesn't know whether it's licensed or authorized when it goes into your arm.
Thank you for that. So the emergency use authorization tag, it is my understanding that a typical flu virus is every year when the concoction is determined and the best educated guesses are made about what strains are going to be most virulent and problematic, that those are also administered under EUA year in and year out. Is that true?
That is true. Flu shots year to year have always fall under the EUA. Many, many medications fall under the EUA because of the lengthy process sometimes it gets to get to a formal FDA approval. What we saw, however, with COVID vaccines were phase 1-3 trials, Pfizer 40,000, Moderna 30,000, placebo versus the active component, the gold standard of study. That has never been done with influenza vaccines year to year and year. So not only is it we're concerned, okay, well, it's the labeling, one's FDA, one's EUA, but the scrutiny and the performance and validity prior to going to the VRBPAC meetings last year, late December, was phenomenal in regard to the degree, the granularity, the microscopic scrutiny that went to get these vaccines approved. So yes, many things fall under EUA, but more importantly, these were the more than influenza has ever done year to year is that we actually looked in a placebo-controlled way, not just at a laboratory, but also clinical outcome perspective to present these for formal approval, first under the EUA and then the FDA. And these were not rushed. It was an expedited process, but that expedited process was still going through the same hoops to meet that phase one, phase two, phase three type of placebo-controlled trial. And we just don't typically do that with influenza. So it's not just the labeling, but also looking at exactly how the sausage was made. And it was very difficult and used very the appropriate steps in the scientific method to be sure that we're making the right recommendation for a global population.
If I can add to that, the term experimental has been applied to these vaccines by several people. I don't know what that means. These are not experimental by any means. They have been out there in the world. They've been used by, as I said, hundreds of millions of people. They're safe and proven effective. They're proven effective in the field. So there's nothing experimental about these at all. They've gone through the rigorous process that Dr. Roth just described. And they're better tested than almost any drugs that we have out there.
And to segue that to a larger discussion about science itself, and one of the interesting things I think we as a society have had is that we have seen with science as it relates to this pandemic, variance in terms of thoughts about certain issues, whether it's natural immunity versus vaccinated immunity, or as you have stated, the best immunity is natural plus vaccinated immunity. And I'm wondering if, Dr. Rubin, you could comment on why science has these different perspectives and why we see this variance out there.
You know, that's a great question. And it addresses what I do most of my time as a journal editor. In fact, all of science is full of people with different opinions. And they express those opinions and oftentimes very loudly. But most of the world doesn't hear them because it's not the middle of a huge epidemic. In fact, opinions count for nothing in science. Proof counts for something. And it's the job of scientists and science journals like mine to try to figure out what's true and what's not based on evidence. So what we're seeing is all the noise that always goes on, but now it's out on the internet and people are picking up on it in a way that's unfiltered. One of our jobs as credible scientists is to try to be the filters, to try to figure out what's right and what's not.
Thank you very much, Dr. Rubin. That's very helpful, and I appreciate that. Certainly, the science will continue to evolve as Dr. Roth illuminated on the research ongoing with natural immunity. We'll certainly learn more as we navigate our way out of the pandemic.
Let's talk natural immunity. And Dr. Roth, how about let's go with your take on that first, please, sir.
Yes, and this is a moving target. We first weren't sure whether the antibody response of the coronavirus, which is like a cold virus, and we get colds all too frequently. It's always around March for whatever reason. That's when I get my cold. But if natural immunity was so great for coronaviruses, we'd never get it again, like natural immunity is for chickenpox. We get chickenpox when we're little. If we get it naturally, we do have a vaccine for it as well. But if you get it, you never get it again. And that's just not the way it is with coronaviruses. There's a lot more in the sauce there to explain why, but they're just different. So natural immunity doesn't always work. However, we are looking at antibody titers, which is different than just T cells and B cells. And antibody titers seem to be lasting pretty darn long. We've got some going 10 months out at least after the wild type COVID individuals were infected. We here at APA offered, we're way ahead of the game. We offered antibody testing to look at natural immunity prior to vaccination. And that was a LabCorp 164055, a LabCorp 164055. We offer, still offer to all of our members to see if they qualitatively, it's just binary, positive or not, do they have a positive titer against coronavirus? But it really doesn't show you the amount. And LabCorp has worked on it. We've been pushing them. We wanted to get some of the data that came from the pharmaceutical companies of how we can look at the level, which is not binary, but it's quantitative. And right now we have a semi-quantitative test, and we may want to offer that to our membership. We may be able to correlate the degree of your antibody titer from natural infection, and then potentially leverage that as a alternative means of compliance, another aviation term. But that test is a 164092. I think we're going to get better than the 164092, where we actually can correlate the level of a semi-quantitative titer with an individual's true protective immunity. But right now, the immunity that we have proven is immunity that comes from the vaccines, keeping you out of the hospital, keeping you from getting sick, and keep you from dying. That's the benefit of the vaccines. We have not necessarily seen that to the equivalent of people with natural acquired antibodies, natural acquired infection, and then saying, where are they in reducing their morbidity and mortalities for second hits in regards to the individuals that do or don't have those titers? And the benefit of this, of the length of this unfortunate epidemic, this pandemic we're in, is we're getting more and more data. But that data will be there. But if something doesn't show a benefit, or something's risk is more than the benefit, I'm the first to say, hey, let's regroup on that. So I'm clearly an advocate right now of the vaccines. I would like to also be able to advocate with certainty that natural acquired antibodies that we can test for are another part of a vaccine passport, if you will. But I just can't say that so strongly just yet. But the tests are coming, Mr. President.
Anything to add to that discussion, Dr. Rubin?
Yes, I think that's a very useful way of putting it. I'd add that when people become infected, they have different responses. As one can imagine, there are some people who produce high titer antibodies and perhaps other immune responses that are useful. And there are those who don't produce such high responses. It looks as if the vaccines produce a more even response in that the protection levels are pretty consistent from vaccination. But I will say one thing that we do know among all these unknowns: for people who have been infected and are subsequently vaccinated, they have sky-high antibody levels, and they likely correlate with very good protection. So the best situation you can be in is to have been infected and then be vaccinated. That appears to be the group with the best protection against disease and perhaps against things that we talked about before, like onward transmission of disease.
Okay, great, Dr. Roth. So that's the boat I'm in. Let's see, it was over Thanksgiving 20 that I had the virus. For me, it was quite mild. And then I was vaccinated in April. So I'm coming up on 6 months. So sign me up for that new test just to figure out what zone we're in, because I'm curious to see how that works in a case like mine, because I know I'm not alone amongst our pilots.
Yes, Eric, I'll be happy to sign you up for that. And again, we as we get more data, it's to our benefit to be able to then bring that data in to see clinical outcome. Rule number one that I always teach when I teach my younger residents is never treat the lab, treat the patient. And yes, this is a lab, but it doesn't necessarily at this time correlate absolutely that this is warranting the protection that we have seen with the vaccine. Just by having something in your hand that says this is a positive titer, a positive antibody at a high level, we need more data with coronavirus specifically to say, does that give you the same protection, for instance, when we look at a hepatitis B titer? We know if you have a titer greater than 10 units, international units of hepatitis B, that you're protected from a needle stick in the hospital, not get hepatitis B. We give hepatitis B to across the world. The first vaccine you get before you leave the neonatal unit is hepatitis B. And we know those titers mean protection. We just don't know that yet. What we will about the tests that are specifically looking at a post-vaccination titer or a post-natural acquired infection titer. The test is there, but we cannot correlate that absolutely yet, meaning a lab equals protection. The aviation community is a bit different. It's a closed space moving at 8/10 or 9/10 of speed of sound. Well, in Gulfstream world, it's 9/10 of speed of sound, but it's a closed space. The benefit of that closed space, though, is the air turnover. In a hospital, the best air turnover we can do is about 6 times an hour for a TB room. And in a closed airplane, we're moving that air 3 times that. 20, 30 times an hour of air handling, either out the outflow valve or through HEPA filtration, and we are not seeing droves of individuals from airborne-associated in-flight transmission. It's a safe place. I think we need to stress that both to our crew members as well as our passengers, and we've just not I don't think are getting the message strong enough that the safest part of their leg from when they leave their house and then finally get to their hotel, the safest part of those transportation legs is the legs while they're on an American Airlines flight.
So, Dr. Rubin, I assume you fly on airliners quite regularly. And so as a passenger, not in the industry, what are your thoughts about riding on an airliner? What gives you comfort these days, knowing in the COVID environment that we are today still, pandemic environment, what are your thoughts about getting on an airliner?
Well, I'm an American Airlines frequent flyer, and I certainly love to travel. The nice thing about aircraft is that it's a very controlled environment. We heard Dr. Roth earlier talk about the number of air exchanges and how infectious diseases don't transmit particularly well on planes. That's reassuring. Unlike real life, you can get on a plane, you can know everyone's going to wear a mask. That's very reassuring. Everything that we know about our fellow passengers, everything we know about the physical controls around what's going on, I think offers tremendous reassurance to the flying public. I find it less reassuring, honestly, when some of the debates become public. A lot of them are among passengers. And I really regret the fact that there has been increased violence on planes. But in fact, the very fact that this is a controlled environment is what offers many of us tremendous reassurance.
Glad you said that. It's interesting right now because of the rarity of known transmissions in our environment amongst our passengers. It's probably less than, you're probably less likely to get the virus using the other prophylactic measures that are in that space right now than you are to get hurt by an unruly passenger, it seems, from what we're hearing. The data seems to be piling up that way. That's just subjective, but we are seeing unruly passengers related to compliance with the current rules regularly, and that seems to be more of a hazard to the flying public than does the possibility of catching the COVID in an airliner.
Before you go, Dr. Roth, you know, you're an AME as well as an infectious disease expert, and we've gotten a lot of gather a lot of feedback, and on the subject of vaccine side effects here at Arab Medical, we get very little, frankly. The one data point that we do have within our own medical advisor team is that some pilots have needed more than 48 hours to recover from the second dose. With your experience out there in the field as an AME, have you seen any pilots out there report significant side effects from the vaccines, any three of them, that have resulted in their loss of their FAA medical?
Thank you, Peter. I just got back from our first in-person large meeting that included most of the regional flight surgeons. I was one-on-one with the federal air surgeon, Susan Northrup. We're discussing a lot of the different avenues where we look downstream about what we're seeing, and that is an area that isn't even on the radar. There are likely some cases post-vaccination. People do sometimes post-vaccination have a different adverse event profile as opposed to the typical side effect profile. But we're just not seeing. It's not even on the radar. What is on the radar is individuals. We have now fully publish the procedures, the document, the algorithm for people that have that are post-COVID, who have had COVID, and for their AMEs to not cause significant deferral at all, unless you've seen a hospital and required ICU stay or developed significant organ injury. We are letting all of the AMEs without deferral issue at the time of their medical. But no, the vaccination, a vaccine-associated illness from the vaccine in the AME office causing impacts or deleterious effects for AMEs not to be able to issue is not even on the radar in from the regional flight surgeon level and at the federal air surgeon level.
Okay, thank you both. Thank you, everyone, for their thoughts here. So APA is working hard to ensure that all of our pilots, regardless of vaccination status, can remain in the employ of this company, but in a safe environment. We're going to ensure that it is a safe environment for all. Our position has been from the beginning that we believe that this is a personal choice. The decision whether or not to be vaccinated is a personal choice between an individual and their doctor. And American Airlines took the same position. But at the end of September, the Biden administration decided to make a mandate affecting federal contractors, of which American is. American Airlines didn't ask for that. APA didn't ask for that. And we're doing the best we can to navigate these waters, which are fraught with disagreement. They're fraught with challenges. And we urge our pilots to leave that discussion out of the flight deck. The most important thing is to know that you are well for work, which you can achieve more likely than not through vaccination or other means, perhaps regular testing. And we are making headway on that. So we have gone from September, the end of September, when the guidance was published, leading up to an October 6th letter from the company, which abruptly reversed its policy of saying it's your personal choice, to then saying either get the vaccination or lose your job, to a time today where American Airlines and even the White House, and I'm not promoting what we're hearing out of the White House or the company for that matter, but it is clear now that people will not be losing their job on the eve of Thanksgiving this year or on the day after December 7th, okay, December 8th, for what it's worth. At this point, progress is being made. It appears that the administration is listening and understands the negative effects here on our industry, highly safety sensitive industry and highly sensitive to disruptions for any number of reasons. We've been heard. The arc of the story is moving our direction, and it should give comfort to our pilots and allow them to put this and keep this discussion out of the flight decks and allow their union to continue to do what it's doing, much of which is behind the scenes. And I know it's not gratifying to many of our members that believe that our chief objective should be complaining to the administration and fighting with all our might against the mandate. That is not necessarily, that could be a path, but we are most interested in the path that's going to get you to the destination. It may not be the path you want, but the destination will be your ability to continue flying here at American Airlines. And my confidence is growing every day that that will be the case. And that is in large part due to the efforts, the very reasoned, often behind the scenes effort of the association, which you can see in some of the things that are being said by the White House, for that matter. And I'm not, again, vouching for or advocating for those statements. I really don't care for some of them either. That, for instance, the I'm just the messenger here, the statement that said the first step won't be termination, it will be education and counseling. I'm not, I knew that would not make some people happy. It didn't make me happy either. But things do seem to be headed the direction we like, putting aside some of those missteps. No guarantees. We're going to keep working, and we're trying to get that out there and obvious and clear so that we don't and are not distracted, that we're not distracted by these anxieties. We're not distracted by these uncertainties. They're untenable in the flight deck, and you just got to do what you do. You've got to compartmentalize the I'm safe, which is illness, medication, stress. What is the rest of that? Alcohol, fatigue, and emotions. That's the I'm safe checklist. Use that. Make sure you're safe before you show up and fly one of these jets. There's way too much at stake to do anything else. And but again, we are encouraging our pilots to take it easy, take a deep breath, and know that we are going to get you, I believe, where you need to go. and put aside all of the anger that has just stemmed from the mandate, which was unexpected. So thank you for your patience on that as we continue with these policies. And thank you, Dr. Rubin. I'm going to turn it over to part of our efforts here. Captain Gillespie, you will have the final word and take us home here, if you would. Let's talk about what Aeromedical is doing to support our pilots in this zone of uncertainty, which has been so challenging.
Well, first off, Dr. Rubin and Dr. Roth, thank you so very much for your insights in the past, as well as today and our future conversations down the road. I am hopeful that we are navigating our way out of this pandemic, but certainly developments around the world still keeps us on our toes on that front. But you've been extremely enlightening for our group, and I look forward to a continued conversation. For our pilots out there, we recognize that there is a lot of stress as it relates to this federal mandate. As you may all be aware, we've set up our hotline, 848 APA crew. And if you select option 9, you can be connected to one of our Project Wingmen or SERP volunteers to help answer questions as it relates to the federal mandate and vaccines. The data is and the information changes by the day. So what's said today may in fact be slightly different than tomorrow, but we're here for you. Then as well, if you dial that same number and you need somebody to talk to, maybe it's not vaccines, maybe it's stress, something going on at home, something going on at work. You know, Project Wingman is available. SERP is available if you're at work. HIMSS is available if that's going on. So never hesitate to reach out. We're here to support you and we'll get through this very difficult time. Again, thank you, Dr. Rubin and Dr. Roth, and we look forward to talking with you again in the future.
Gentlemen, very informative. We really appreciate the time you've spent with us, and we also want to thank those who took the time to listen. And that's all for now, and thanks again.